your point of view, but has a different perspective might say, because I'm very interested in understanding a bit more about what you've been saying. I can imagine someone saying, absolutely, the market is not meeting the needs, especially of people at the lowest end of the income spectrum, and perhaps the market can't. And the withdrawal of governments from new affordable housing investments, and also the retreat on things like rent control, have created a situation that needs to be reversed. At the same time, there's a broader supply problem, which demands more housing, which will really only the private sector is in a position to provide because of the way our economy and our housing market works. Is that crazy, or is that consistent or compatible with the perspective that you're laying out?
It's compatible, I think. You know, I do think that in certain, like, you know, the single family home, for example, like, should it, from a climate perspective and, you know, from a community perspective, should it continue to be the ideal? That's a whole other conversation, right? But, you know, I would argue probably no, but that's a different conversation. But, you know, like, for folks who can afford to participate in housing in the private market, sure, right? Like, and, you know, like I've said to developers, like, yeah, great, go and build me a home. I live in a privately owned home. So, you know, no big deal there. But really it is, and this is where our lab is focusing on more, is really that low to mid range, like low to middle income folks. Because it's becoming, like, we look at, you know, in the past, it was really, we would focus on folks who were experiencing deep poverty. So often those who were on social assistance or disability supports. And like affording anything off of that in New Brunswick, it's like $639 a month for social assistance for a single adult. Find me an apartment that you can rent for that. You can't, right? So where do you live? Well, I don't know, right? Like, this is becoming a huge issue. You can maybe get a room in a house, maybe. So the low to mid range, and I say to mid now because now we see folks who are making minimum wage who can't afford anything out there in the market, or even slightly better than minimum wage. And that's where we see these government solutions coming in. And that's where we see the biggest push for decommodification needed.
I understand you're working on a new national survey. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. That one's an interesting one. It should be hopefully launching in the new year. The new national survey we're working on is actually funded through the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation through their 2022 President's Medal for Outstanding Housing Research, which my work on the flooding received. And the work itself, or the survey itself, actually was supposed to be focus groups originally. We were going to do focus groups with folks who had experienced housing displacement or loss or damage because of climate or climate disasters. And then all of a sudden, Canada went on fire this summer, and there were fires absolutely everywhere. So then I decided to turn it into a survey, just to kind of get at some of those realities without being as invasive to folks who were living through, when I was starting writing the survey draft, who were living actively through climate disasters. So basically what we're doing is we are doing a large survey to look at people's experiences of either displacement, so if they were asked to leave their housing during a fire, evacuation, damage, or destruction of their homes. So they have to fit into one of those three categories, and they have to relate this to some kind of severe weather event. So whether it be a fire, a flood, et cetera. And basically what we're looking for is we're looking to see how their needs were met or not met, how different aspects of vulnerability, so for example, gender, age, health status, how those impacted their experiences of the disaster. And then we're going to be asking them a little bit about policy as well, too. So what do they think governments should do to respond to the very real threat of losing housing because of climate disasters that seems to be, you know, and is increasing, and I believe will continue to increase as we sort of move along in time.
Well, it sounds like a really exciting and certainly a timely project, and one that is only going to get more relevant, I think, as we go forward. Thank you so much for this, Julia. It's been really interesting and informative conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Big Thinking Podcast and to my guest, Julia Woodhull Melnick, Associate Professor at the University of New Brunswick. I also want to thank our friends and partners at the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and at Cited Media, whose support helps make this podcast possible. Let us know what you thought of this episode and share your feedback with us on social media. If you enjoy the Big Thinking Podcast, check out Social Science Bites. It's a podcast series appearing on Sage's Social Science Space website. The monthly episodes offer 20-minute interviews with leading social and behavioral scientists who share their perspectives on topics ranging from crowd psychology and behavioral economics to inequality and even the fear of death. Follow us for more episodes of the Big Thinking Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast. À la prochaine.
As a CJSF listener, you are the outlier, the rebellious one, the change maker, the hopeful dreamer, the truth seeker. And we delight in you for being those things. On behalf of all of us making the radio you listen to, thank you for making CJSF a part of your life.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
This is a Radio Labor Canada report recorded on Friday, April 25th, 2025. I'm Mark Belanger. In the report this week, unions condemn the use of the notwithstanding clause of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The Labor Start report of union events and singing.
For every stitch of clothing, someone sweats away unseen. While the tangled threads of justice unravel at the seams.
This is Radio Labor.
Right now we're asking for a public consultation on the use of the notwithstanding clause within 6 months of forming the government. Quite frankly, I'd like to see provincial governments passing legislation, albeit maybe just a symbolic move, saying that they're not going to use the notwithstanding clause and take away the rights of Canadians.
That is Mark Hancock, the president of the Canadian Union of Public Employees. CUPE has joined with the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, the Canadian Labour Congress, and other labour organizations to demand an end to the use of the notwithstanding clause of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I asked Mr. Hancock what the notwithstanding clause is and when it was created.
Well, it was created, I believe, in 1982, the last time the Constitution went through a major rewrite, and it basically gives government lawmakers the ability to disregard certain rights and freedoms that are protected by our Canadian Charter, such as the freedoms of expression, of religion, freedom to life, and the right to be treated equally under the law. And, of course, included in there as well, from what we've had to deal with, is around labor as well and our rights as trade unions.
Was the clause designed to be used frequently or rarely?
Oh, absolutely rarely. And I know that there are certain times, and probably mostly in Quebec, where it has been used to protect language, Quebec culture. So that's the place that I've seen it the most. But it has been used in other provinces, but very sparingly. It's a handful of times that I'm aware that it's been used.
Do you have any examples of how the clause has been used or been threatened to be used?
Been used on us in Ontario. Doug Ford, under his government, our education workers, and I believe it was 2022, and our education workers in the province, about 55,000 of them, were in negotiations, and the government, the Conservative government, called our bargaining committee and our staff to a meeting where he let us know that he was bringing in a collective agreement that had not been negotiated, and that collective agreement included concessions. It included very minimal, really fair wage increases, and also took away the ability for our locals to negotiate locally with the local school boards. And in that, he also used a notwithstanding clause. And of course, that was a huge hammer that was being used. Some people have called it, including myself, a nuclear option, where this isn't the first time that we've had a collective agreement imposed, wrongfully imposed on our members. But in those situations, we've always had the right to take on that legislation in the courts. And we've been very successful fighting back in the courts in Ontario and in other provinces when legislation is brought in that either strips our collective agreement rights or imposes collective agreements. So by Premier Ford using the notwithstanding clause, he took away our right as a trade union representing those 55,000 workers to exercise our fundamental rights, which is protected under the charter, to use the court to take on the fact that collective bargaining had not been followed and that this contract was being imposed on our education members in Ontario. We realized, of course, that that was the effect. And our education workers, 55,000 members in Ontario, stood up and defied that legislation. Primarily, for a couple of reasons. I mean, times were very tough for education workers. A lot of them were not making enough money to provide for themselves, their families. And I mean, there was many examples of folks having to utilize food banks in order to feed their families. Some were living in their cars because they had to travel great distances from where they lived to work. They couldn't afford to be in the same community where they worked. And as a result, the legislation was passed on the Thursday. And on the Friday, we defied the legislation, and education workers all across Ontario walked off the job. And quite frankly, it was illegal. And it was a very proud moment for me as their national president. And it was just 3 days later on Monday morning when Ford recognized the resistance was building, other unions to support us, other QP members and locals from across the country. We were standing up and saying that the use of the notwithstanding clause to oppose this collective agreement on these education workers was wrong, and workers across the country and in Ontario were saying that it was not acceptable and that the strike, albeit illegal, was going to continue on and escalate through the coming days and weeks. There was still some negotiations going on, and what we were told was we had up until the time that the law was passed to negotiate a collective agreement. But trying to negotiate a contract with a hammer being held over your head is not a way to successfully reach a collective agreement.
You mentioned support from the other unions. Tell me about that. Who supported you? What did they say?
I remember having conversations with a multitude of union leaders. There was emergency meetings called by the Canadian Labour Congress. B. Brusk is the president there. And we had support very loudly from affiliates across the country. Canadian unions, international unions, public sector unions, private sector unions, the support was universal. And at that point, some of these unions that have relationships or had relationships with the premier and with the government were reaching out to the government and letting them know that they were pissed off with this legislation and the use of the notwithstanding clause, letting them know that they would be supporting QP. And what that looked like was a variety of things. You know, we had our friends in private sector talking about shutting down mills, shutting down plants, shutting down all kinds of things. It was going to be an escalated process. And we also had our own locals in the public sector in QP in Ontario talking about shutting down their work sites, whether it was municipalities, whether it was social services or post-secondary, the full gamut of where we represent folks. But that went to other unions as well, like OPSU and SEIU. And of course, you know, we were going to make sure that residents were looked after. We weren't going to abandon hospitals and put people's lives at risk. But the uproar from the rest of the labor movement was very loud and very clear. And as was the uproar from the public. The public did not want to have an education worker strike in Ontario. Nobody ever wants to have that. But folks soon saw what that legislation, and including the notwithstanding clause, meant for us as workers in Ontario, but also potentially for them. The public support was extremely overwhelming, and we don't necessarily have the support of many in the media, but in that specific case, it was pretty blanket support for those workers and against that legislation and against Ford using the notwithstanding clause.
The clause was meant to be used in extraordinary circumstances. But it seems that conservative governments are eager to apply the notwithstanding clause. Why do you think this is?
Well, it makes it easier for them to ram legislation through the provincial bodies. They don't have to worry about the courts. And as I mentioned a bit earlier, this wasn't the first time we'd seen a legislated collective agreement or a legislated attack on our rights as workers. But in those cases, we had had the ability to protest, of course, but then also to utilize the courts. And that was an important piece because we have won many victories in the courts when collective agreements have been imposed or when strict conditions around bargaining have been legislated. And I think of Bill 124 in Ontario, again, where our wage patterns, we'll say wage patterns, our wages were set, our wage increases were set. And time again, the court at all levels have said that an infringement on workers' rights is not on, and that governments have been forced to come back to the table and to negotiate conditions that the workers wanted. And we've seen this in the States, too. Donald Trump has time and time again ignored what the courts have said. He sees them as an inconvenience, and of course that's the fear that Pierre Poilievre and a federal conservative government, if they're elected, would trample all over our rights as Canadians.
What is QP and the Civil Liberties Association asking for?
Right now, we're asking for a public consultation on the use of the notwithstanding clause within 6 months of forming the government. Quite frankly, I'd like to see provincial governments passing legislation, albeit maybe just a symbolic move, saying that they're not going to use the notwithstanding clause and take away the rights of Canadians. And I know that was one thing that I was discussing with a number of folks back when we were facing this abuse of the notwithstanding clause with Premier Ford. I had conversations with folks in governments across the country, with senators in Canada, and even had a couple of conversations with the Prime Minister of the day, Prime Minister Trudeau, about Premier Ford's use of the notwithstanding clause. And everybody was in agreement that this was not a case where this clause should be used.
Here with his report about union events is Labour Star correspondent Derek Blackadder.
This week, the top stories sections on our Canadian, French, and English language pages included a few interesting analytical pieces regarding the federal election and how working class interests aren't, for the most part, being represented. And of course, lots and lots of reminders from unions to get out and vote, and even some suggestions here and there that they should vote according to those interests. We also carried a piece from the CLC on the anniversary of the Rana Plaza disaster. The name is probably burnt into your memory, but just in case, Rana Plaza was a garment factory in Bangladesh that collapsed, killing 1,134 workers, most of them young women, and seriously injuring over 2,500 others. It was, in short, a massive industrial homicide. In part, the CLC marks the anniversary each year, as do several major Canadian unions, because there is and was a Canadian connection to the disaster. Several Canadian clothing brands used, and still use, contractors in countries like Bangladesh, Nicaragua, Ethiopia, and Indonesia to produce the clothes that they sell. There's often little or no monitoring of working conditions in those factories, even though the brands have the power to force improvements. Some, at the very least, are Rana Plazas waiting to happen. The Congress's article is worth a read. Among other things, it provides a short summary of what the labor movement here has been doing in solidarity with workers facing down Canada-based corporations elsewhere. Also a top story this week was a report on the inclusion of a no-discrimination on the basis of caste provision in the new PSAC agreement at Queen's University, a first as far as I can recall. But my favorite item, among our Canadian stories at least, was the news that Canadian comedians, members of the Canadian Association of Stand-Up, Sketch, and Improv Comedians, or CASC, have joined my local union, Unifor's Canadian Freelance Union. Welcome, comrades. This should be fun and funny. I'm hoping our next membership meeting will be at Just for Laughs. Okay. Bad joke. This week's Labor Start podcast is an interview with Dr. Debbie Goldman. She worked for 28 years at the Communications Workers of America and is an expert on the subject of call center workers. She and our editor, Eric Lee, discussed her new book, Disconnected: Call Center Workers Fight for Good Jobs in the Digital Age. They talked about issues like surveillance in the workplace, how the CWA won impressive victories in defense of call center worker rights, and how employers export call center jobs abroad, only to run up against international trade union solidarity. The podcast ends with a discussion about whether the much-touted momentum of unionization in the USA in 2024 has continued under Trump. Among the Canadian items appearing on our health and safety page and newswear this week were, of course, stories about upcoming Day of Mourning events across the country. Several provincial federations of labor provide listings of events, so it's easy to find one near you. And while the Day of Mourning started here in Canada, it's now marked around the world. So even if, like me, you're currently out of the country, you can still join in. Another Canadian invention is Labor Start's photo of the week. This week, we carried a photo from Brussels, where last week leaders of the European Public Service Union held an anti-fascist action during an executive committee meeting on the 80th year of the defeat of fascism. Delegates visited and cleaned the memorial stone of Richard Lipper, a young Belgian resistance fighter executed by the Nazis in 1944. Francoise Ngeng, EPSU president, spoke at the ceremony and said, "Richard Lipper stood against fascism with courage and conviction. Today, as trade unionists, we remember that resistance is not just history. It is a responsibility. Our message is simple. No to fascism, not then and not now." It's impossible for me not to add a comment to the effect celebrating the end of fascism these days may be a little premature. Labor's history is what our current struggles are built on, and this week we mark the anniversaries of these events. This week in 1974, and as part of a targeted campaign for pay equity, postal workers began a 7-day illegal strike that won women postal code machine operators the same pay as male postal clerks. In 2023, after more than a year of bargaining, 155,000 public service workers across 30 federal departments went out on a successful strike, marking one of the largest strikes by federal employees in Canadian history. And in 1956, more than 1,600 delegates attended the founding convention of the Canadian Labour Congress, a merger of the Trades and Labour Congress and the Canadian Congress of Labour. They called for a national health plan, full employment, and a guaranteed annual wage. There are a lot more history items like this to be found at the bottom of our Canadian news pages. Look for them and be inspired. Labor Start hosts online solidarity actions at the request of unions around the world. This week, we'd like to highlight urgent appeals for online solidarity with trade union activists in Azerbaijan who have been jailed for attempting to organize unions that don't toe the government's line. That line being no unions as they interfere with profits. If you can spare just a few seconds, you can do your part in struggles like these by sending a solidarity or protest message. Look for details on our site. Before I go, a quick shout out to all the Labour candidates carrying the NDP banner in the federal election. Thanks. Get some rest. This is Derek Blackadder from Labour Start, reporting for Radio Labour.
Now here are the Low Tide Drifters with Every Stitch.
city to the streets of Bangladesh. 100 years of struggle, it ain't over yet.
That's it. Labor news you can use. I'm Mark Belanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about solidarity.
Tune in to CJSF, you make a choice to step outside of the box of what's normal and support an alternative. Alternatives are critical for making change, which we need so, so badly. I'm Leslie, host of Typically Tuesdays, on Mondays at 3 p.m., and I see you contributing to social change in your small and profound ways simply by tuning into us. Thanks for being on our team.
You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.